Hello, you're listening to Talking Points on BoardGameAuthority.com. I'm your host, Richard Miles. All right, so I'm very excited about my guest today. You all know him as the man, the myth, the legend, Jamie Stegmeyer. Jamie, welcome, and thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Hey, Richard, thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I am confident that the majority of our listeners are very familiar with who you are, whether it's from the success of Stonemaier Games or just your generous Kickstarter lessons blog. Either way, most people in the gaming industry are familiar with who you are. And so your success, as evident of the current Kickstarter campaign that you have for Tuscany, is only continuing to grow. So tell me, how does it feel to be Jamie Stegmeyer right now?
Yeah, I feel very fortunate to be in the position where I am right now. And especially during Tuscany, one thing that I've noticed during this campaign is that it's just been a really positive campaign. Like I ran a campaign for Viticulture and Euphoria, my other games, and it kind of felt a little bit like I was just putting out fires all over the place. I was having some great interactions with people, but it kind of felt like that every day. And with Tuscany, I don't know really what's going on. Maybe I've just figured this out better. Or I think really there are just a lot of great backers that were attracted to the project. And yeah, I feel really good right now.
Well, I think a lot of that is there's a confidence built in now. This isn't your first time. And as I mentioned, a lot of people are very familiar with you. I have heard your blog referred to as the Bible of Kickstarter, or the Kickstarter Bible. And so that's a term that people are throwing around. If someone is interested in starting a Kickstarter campaign, the first piece of advice that anybody gives is go visit your blog. That's part of the reason why this campaign, like you're just so well known now that this campaign, people just have that confidence.
Right. And that's a lot of what Kickstarter is about, I've learned. It's about building up that trust with people over time. And I do this, like I usually, when people ask me if they've already heard of my blog and they ask for something else, I usually recommend Richard Bliss's Funding the Dream podcast. I guess he kind of does what I do in podcast form.
Right. I listen to that myself. I have listened to almost every single one of his podcasts. I listen to him on my way home from work. So I usually get two of them in. That's my awesome commute time. and I can listen to two complete episodes of his. So you've quickly become a major force in the board game space. Right now, you're kind of king of the hill. You have a very successful campaign running right now for Tuscany. Some companies don't even make $300,000 in a year, and Tuscany has already passed that mark. Combine that kind of success with the fame of your blog, you're essentially a rock star. So, and I bring that up not to pad your ego or anything like that, but I bring that up to say, despite all of the success, you're still super generous with your time and your knowledge. You continue to pump out your helpful blog post. You take the time out of your day to talk to people like me. And so for that, and on behalf of everybody that I've talked to that says, you know, read Stegmeyer's blog. You know, he's the guy to go to just absorb all that. For all of those people, myself included, I do want to thank you. I told myself if I ever get a chance to speak with you, like I need to thank you because you're part of the reason I have this podcast. I mean, so I definitely want to get that out of the way. I don't need to, you know, make you want to feel awkward or uncomfortable or anything, but I definitely wanted to take just a moment to say that. I mean, your posts are invaluable and you're truly an inspiration. So thank you for that.
Well, yeah, that means a lot to hear from you and to hear from other people who have taken the initiative to start a blog or a podcast and start creating helpful content for other people. I mean, that's why I do it. And it's, I think one of the first entries on the Kickstarter blog is that I recommend to other people that they start a blog or podcast or video series just to add value to other people. So I really admire that you took the initiative to do that yourself as well.
Yeah. So that is exactly one of the first things that I read. And you say in that post, you're like, seriously, do it right now.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. Like, just do it.
Yeah, writing that first entry or doing that first podcast, it really breaks the ice. Because up until that point, I think people tend to plan a lot of what it will be. And similar to like designing a game, like really the first test of the game is when it hits the table for the first time and you realize that it's nothing like you anticipated it would be. And that the thing that you're really excited about is different than what you thought would be excited about. And the same happens with blogs and podcasts. So yeah, breaking the ice, I've found, just makes a huge difference.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Let's get into a few questions here. Besides quitting your day job, what has been the biggest change in your life as a result of Stonemaier Games?
For a long time, or for my entire life, pretty much after college, I've had a full-time job, and then in the last couple of years, I've been running Stonemaier Games too. And so every day, pretty much, my schedule was to go to my full-time job and then come home and work for another 5 or 6 hours on Stonemaier, and then rinse and repeat every day. And so the biggest, and so that I found that it started to limit my social life quite a bit, and I'm not even that social of a person, but it really started to limit it. And so the biggest change that I've noticed is that I am so much more free now to say yes to people when they want to go out to dinner, or they want to get lunch, or they want to play games. I play games a lot more than I did before, and that as someone who's trying to run a game company, I think that makes a huge difference that I'm playing all these games
Oh,
all the
yeah.
time. Like after this podcast, someone texted me an hour ago and said, "Hey, you want to come play games tonight?" I was like, "Yeah, after this podcast I'm recording, I'd love to." And beforehand, I would never have been able to say that because my nighttime hours were spent running the company.
Right. I've heard you mention about that you actually did like your job. So how difficult of a decision was that? Because you quit that back in December, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
And so that's before Tuscany launched, before this very successful campaign. So you didn't have that knowledge of you're going to have this hugely successful campaign. So how difficult was it to actually put in your notice to quit?
Well, I would say the difficult part was, well, it's kind of like breaking up with a girlfriend after you've dated for a long time. And I dated this particular company for 6 years, this organization, and it was tough to break up with them and say goodbye. But the choice itself was very calculated. So by the time I made that decision, it was, I had run the numbers, I'd run the budget, and pretty much it added up to, if all else failed and Stonemaier really didn't work out in 2014, then I would have about a year to figure that out before I ran out of money and had to get another job. And so I would kind of see that coming. So it was largely dependent on retail sales of Euphoria and some other deals that I brokered with like a company in Europe that's going to be making European language versions of our games. These other side deals started coming out that made the company not as dependent on Kickstarter itself, and that kind of enabled me to make that decision and have other sources of income, because Kickstarter itself isn't really a source of income for me. That's a source of cash flow so that I can make a bunch of games and ship a bunch of games, but it's not really, that doesn't pay my salary. My
Right.
salary comes from retail sales.
Right. You can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe at least at one point you were using Impressions as the distribution service.
That's correct. Yeah, Impressions serves as a distribution broker, kind of between me and distributors. So they he has a Aldo there has a great relationship with a bunch of distributors and gets my games in their hands. So I still work with Aldo.
Okay, awesome. If somebody has a successful Kickstarter and they would like to get their game on retail shelves, that Aldo is a guy they should contact.
Yeah, at the very least, I recommend to people that they contact Aldo. He's very responsive, and it does cost a little money because he's serving as a middleman, and so people have to decide if that works for their budget or not, but it's definitely worth reaching out to him.
Right,
Absolutely.
right. Okay, cool. So let's go back in time about 5 years. This is before you've put in anything on Kickstarter. How many games are rolling around in your head at that point?
That's a really interesting question to look back 5 years ago, because 5 years ago, I think Kickstarter celebrated their 5-year anniversary 5 years ago, just the other day. So the Kickstarter has been around for 5 years. I only got into Euro games about 7 or 8 years ago, I would say. I was playing a lot of Settlers of Catan and Agricola. At that point, I've designed games my whole life, but at that point, I was just enjoying discovering all these new games. So I don't know if I had a lot of ideas in my head at that point. It wasn't really until I saw the success of a few games on Kickstarter that I was like, oh, maybe there's something there. Maybe it's worth spending some creative time to explore this passion of mine that I kind of gave up on for a while because I figured it could never be profitable, and that no one would ever play my games.
Right. Had you made any prototypes before you saw any Kickstarter campaigns, like just for your friends or family to play?
Yeah, I started designing games when I was like 7 or 8 years old. So throughout my life, I would say looking back, there's about one game every 2 years that actually made it to the table. And that I would say it pretty much ended when right after college. I think in college I designed a few games, and then after that there was a little gap, and it was just reignited when I started discovering these Euro games, and I started thinking about games in a different way.
Of the games that made it to the table, are any of them in the plans for you to kind of rekindle those?
No, they're
No,
all pretty bad.
they're not good. Okay, fair
Yeah.
enough.
There's only one that I think is halfway decent, and I think it's been done in a better way. I thought of it after playing Scotland Yard as a kid. Are you familiar with
Okay,
Scotland Yard?
yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's a better version of Scotland Yard that's come out. Maybe it's called, Letters to Whitechapel.
Right, I think I've heard of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's funny. I kind of wish growing up that if I had had exposure to these incredible games as an 8 or 9 year old, I just wonder where I would be as a designer today.
What led you to pick Kickstarter instead of pitching your games to traditional publishers?
Well, it really started when I started to see games on Kickstarter, and I started to see the types of interactions that were happening between the backers and the creators. And I was really fascinated by that level of interaction. Like most game companies, they make a game, but they don't. And they probably, I think most game companies have forums where they hear directly from fans. But if you have a game on a shelf at a game store and you sell a copy, I'm talking you as in a game company, you don't have any interaction with that customer when they buy the copy. Whereas on Kickstarter, you potentially have a direct interaction with every single person who backs the game. And I was fascinated by that idea, and I wanted to give it a try. And also, I talk about this on the Kickstarter lessons a lot. I think that, and you mentioned this too, there are a lot of people who just want to design games. And I think that's really important for people to realize that if that's your passion, that maybe going the Kickstarter route isn't a good idea, because Kickstarter involves actually running a business,
Right.
even if it's just for one game. And I just happen to really enjoy running a business. I love logistics and spreadsheets and figuring out the puzzles of making a business work, and all the customer service. I really enjoy that. So all that came together to make me kind of just want to do it all together myself all at once rather than hand it off to a company.
Okay, excellent, excellent. With any type of independent publisher, we see print and play being, I can't say that's super important, but it seems that most small publishers do the print and plays.
Yeah.
Contrast that to big publishers who do not do print and plays. I want to get your input or your thoughts on how important you think the print and plays are for small publishers.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've gone back and forth about print and plays over time. I think if you look through the Kickstarter lessons, you would probably see me arguing with myself over time about the print and play concept. Because during the Euphoria campaign, I didn't fully understand that there are some people who they love to make a print and play, and they use it to replace the actual game.
Right.
And I didn't really realize that people did that. I thought they just used it to test out a game for Kickstarter. And I love that function of the PMP, of a print and play. I like that people can print out at least a portion of a game, test it out to see if it's their type of game.
Right.
But board games are such a tangible experience. I'm trying to create things that people will treasure and touch and feel and move around a table. And so when I learned that about Euphoria, that some backers were doing that with Euphoria, I was like, no, that's not really my intention here. And so for that type of print and play, I'm not a big fan of it. That's not what I want to make. But for print and plays, for people to just to have a little taste test for the game, I liked it. And I think that would be smart for not just small companies, but big companies too. I see some like AEG, I think they usually have like a light version of their games available for in print and play format on their website.
Right. So your suggestion would be to do a slightly modified, not full version, so that people can get their feet wet, so to speak, and see if it is a good fit. So, you can
Right.
try it before you buy it.
Exactly. And I think that usually ends up, especially if there's a game on Kickstarter that has a little bit left of refinement, a little bit refinement left. Sometimes those people who print and play the games, they offer some pretty good feedback and end up improving the game.
Yeah, so for a lot of the smaller companies, And especially independent designers who they are the company. They're trying to do everything. Often they do not seem to be able to play test with the number, just the sheer number, right? They don't have numbers on their side, so the amount of play tests, and it may not be the amount, right? It's not the number of play tests, it's just the number of people, the different people who have play tested it. I think that's where they're beneficial, like you're saying. They can offer that feedback and suggestion from somebody who they just don't have access to as an independent.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one counter argument that we might hear, if there's some listeners right now, international listeners, who have to deal with really high shipping costs, they might say, well, a print and play is my way of, like, they're willing to spend $10 or $15 on a print and play so that they don't have to spend $90 on a game that includes like $40 for the game and $50 for shipping. And
Right.
so to those, I definitely appreciate that. But my response to that would be to project creators, hey, find a better solution to ship the game to these people so they don't have to look for a cheaply made, $10 print and play game. Like, find a good solution for that to get the game to them in the first place.
Right, and that's one thing that I believe that post of how to offer free shipping to essentially anybody who wants it, regardless if you're in the United States, Canada, Mexico, Europe. That post on your blog, I think in your recent, here's my top blog post, I think that's the number one. So
Oh,
that is
by
what,
far, yeah.
yeah, right, by far. So that is what most people are interested in, is how can I offer that kind of free shipping to everybody to just make my game more appealing overseas?
Yeah, and I have seen that catch on. I think this will be the year when people actually have to implement that strategy. So I haven't really gotten an influx of people asking, like, am I doing this right yet? So I'm kind of curious to see if people run into some trouble, because it is not easy. But
Right.
once you kind of get the machine running, it becomes a lot easier.
Right. So let's switch gears just a bit here. You have a regular game night, and you mentioned that you're probably going to go play a game directly after this interview. So what was the last game that you played?
So I had two game night this I hosted two game nights this week. The first one I played Belfort with the Belfort expansion. It's a great little game. And it looks great on the table. It has that kind of five-sided game board. It's a good looking game board. And then a quick game of For Sale when we were done with that. And then I had a game night last night and I played Sulcan with that group. It's a really neat game. And I lost a lot. I haven't won many games recently. But I think that's sometimes a sign where even though I'm not winning these games, I'm still having fun playing them. So that must say something about the games themselves.
Nice. As long as you're having fun, like that's what I try
Right.
and do. I just like to play.
Yeah.
If I'm playing a game, I'm happy. Win or lose, I'm happy.
Yeah. Same here.
So since you are not married, tell me about romance opportunities. Has Stonemaier Games had an impact on the amount of people asking you out?
I like that. That's a fun question. It's definitely impacted my dating life. I just haven't had time to date in quite some time now. But it has made me value the idea of finding a girlfriend who likes games or who's open to playing games and wouldn't dread them, something that I don't have to drag her into, because it is such a big part of my life, and I really like to connect with people over games. So,
Sure.
but in terms of people, women asking me out, I have not. I'm usually the instigator in those situations. I did have a first date recently. I think it was the first date period that I've gone on in like 6 or 7 months. And the thing that caught my eye, it was on OkCupid, an online dating website. And the thing that caught my eye was that she mentioned Settlers of Catan on her profile. So I was like, oh, okay, well, we speak the same language then.
Nice.
I'll give
Yeah.
this a
Yep.
try.
Nice. I was just a little curious about that because I know every, you go to a few conventions, and I was just, there's a few, board game chicks at all the conventions. So I was just wondering if now that you are kind of recognizable, if, people are just kind of, hey, Jamie, what's up? You're kind of running up to you.
I haven't seen a whole lot of that. Like, I wondered if maybe it would happen a little bit at Gen Con, because I had had a pretty visible Kickstarter campaign that summer. But like, I think for the most part, I'm not really anybody to the greater gaming community. And I kind of like it that way. Like, I it's great online to see the interactions, but in person, I kind of just want to play games with people. I don't even want to push my own games upon people when I'm at a convention. I just want to hang out and play whatever anybody wants to play.
Right.
So I'm kind of glad that hasn't happened. Although if I don't know, we'll see what happens. Maybe we'll have this conversation in a year. We'll see if
Right.
it's any different.
Right. Jamie and I talked for quite a while. He's very generous with his time. And since we went over our 20-minute allotment, I decided to split the recordings up into two different episodes. So stay tuned for the second half of my interview with Jamie Stegmeier. I have been your host, Richard Miles, for BoardGameAuthority.com. You can find this podcast on iTunes, or it's always available directly from the website. You can connect with me at Twitter at BoardGameAuth, BoardGameAuth. And we also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/BoardGameAuthority. Feel free to connect, drop us a line, tell us who you want us to interview next, or say that you want to be on the show yourself. I would love to hear from you. Until next time, game on.